essence of bluish leaves, shaped more like feathers than the foliage of any plant known to Jimmy. The stem ended at eye level in what he had first taken to be a single flower. Now he saw, with no surprise at all, that it was actually three flowers tightly packed together. The petals were brightly colored tubes about 5 centimeters long. There were at least 50 in each bloom, and they glittered with such metallic blues, violets, and greens that they seemed more like the wings of a butterfly than anything in the vegetable kingdom. Jimmy knew practically nothing about botany, but he was puzzled to see no trace of any structures resembling pistils or stamens. He wondered if the likeness to terrestrial flowers might be a pure coincidence. Perhaps this was something more akin to a coral polyp. In either case, it would seem to imply the existence of small, airborne creatures to serve either as fertilizing agents or as food. It did not really matter. Whatever the scientific definition, to Jimmy, this was a flower. The strange miracle, the un-Raman-like accident of its existence here, reminded him of all that he would never see again, and he was determined to possess it. That would not be easy. It was more than 10 meters away, separated from him by a latticework made of thin rods. They formed a cubic pattern, repeated over and over, less than 40 centimeters on a side. Jimmy would not have been flying skybikes unless he had been slim and wiry, so he knew he could crawl through the interstices of the grid. But getting out again might be quite a different matter. It would certainly be impossible for him to turn around, so he would have to retreat backward. Hub Control was delighted with his discovery when he had described the flower and scanned it from every available angle. There was no objection when he said, "I'm going after it." Nor did he expect there to be. His life was now his own, to do with as he pleased. He stripped off all his clothes, grasped the smooth metal rods, and started to wriggle into the framework. It was a tight fit. He felt like a prisoner escaping through the bars of his cell. When he had inserted himself completely into the lattice, he tried backing out again, just to see if there were any problems. It was considerably more difficult, since he now had to use his outstretched arms for pushing instead of pulling, but he saw no reason why he should get helplessly trapped. Jimmy was a man of action and impulse, not of introspection. As he squirmed uncomfortably along the narrow corridor of rods, he wasted no time asking himself just why he was performing so quixotic a feat. He had never been interested in flowers in his whole life. Yet now, he was gambling his last energies to collect one. It was true that this specimen was unique and of enormous scientific value, but he really wanted it because it was his last link with the world of life and the planet of his birth. Yet when the flower was within his grasp, he had sudden qualms. Perhaps it was the only flower that grew in the whole of Rama. Was he justified in collecting it? If he needed any excuse, he could console himself with the thought that the Ramans themselves had not included it in their plans. It was obviously a freak, growing ages too late, or too soon. But he did not really require an excuse, and his hesitation was only momentary. He reached out, grasped the stem, and gave a sharp jerk. The flower came away easily enough. He also collected 2 of the leaves before starting to back slowly through the lattice. Now that he had only 1 free hand, progress was extremely difficult, even painful, and he soon had to pause to regain his breath. It was then that he noticed that the feathery leaves were closing, and the headless stem was slowly unwinding itself from its supports. As he watched, with a mixture of fascination and dismay, he saw that the whole plant was steadily retreating into the ground, like a mortally injured snake crawling back into its hole. "I've murdered something beautiful," Jimmy said to himself. But then, Rama had killed him. He was only collecting what was his rightful due. 31. Terminal Velocity. Commander Norton had never yet lost a man, and he had no intention of losing one now. Even before Jimmy had set off for the South Pole, he had been considering ways of rescuing him in the event of accident. The problem had turned out to be so difficult, however, that he had found no answer. All that he had managed to do was to eliminate every obvious solution. How does one climb a half-kilometer vertical cliff, even in reduced gravity? With the right equipment and training, it would be easy enough. But there were no Python guns aboard Endeavor, and no one could think of any other practical way of driving the necessary hundreds of spikes into that hard, mirror surface. He had glanced briefly at more exotic solutions, some, frankly, crazy. Perhaps a simp, fitted with suction pads, could make the ascent. But even if this scheme was practical, how long would it take to manufacture and test such equipment, and to train a simp to use it? He doubted if a man would have the necessary strength to perform the feat. Then, there was more advanced technology. The EVA propulsion units were tempting, but their thrust was too small, since they were designed for zero-G operation. They could not possibly lift the weight of a man, even against Rama's modest gravity. Could an EVA thruster be sent up on automatic control, carrying only a rescue line? He had tried out this idea on Sergeant Myron, who had promptly shot it down. There were, the engineer pointed out, severe stability problems. They might be solved, but it would take a long time, much longer than they could afford. What about balloons? There seemed a faint possibility here, if they could devise an envelope and a sufficiently compact source of heat. This was the only approach that Norton had not dismissed when the problem suddenly ceased to be one of theory and became a matter of life and death, dominating the news in all the inhabited worlds. While Jimmy was making his trek along the edge of the sea, half the crackpots in the solar system were trying to save him. At Fleet Headquarters, all the suggestions were considered, and about 1 in 1,000 was forwarded to Endeavor. Dr. Carlisle Pereira's arrived twice, once via the survey's own network, and once by Planetcom, Rama Priority. It had taken the scientist approximately 5 minutes of thought, and 1 millisecond of computer time. At first, Norton thought it was a joke in very poor taste. Then he saw the sender's name and the attached calculations, and did a quick double-take. He handed the message to Carl Mercer. "What do you think of this?" he asked, in as non-committal a tone of voice as he could manage. Carl read it swiftly, then said, "Well, I'm damned. He's right, of course."
"Are you sure?"
"He was right about the storm, wasn't he? We should have thought of this. It makes me feel a fool."
"You have company. The next problem is, how do we break it to Jimmy?"
"I don't think we should. Until the last possible minute. That's how I'd prefer it if I was in his place. Just tell him we're on the way."
Though he could look across the full width of the cylindrical sea and knew the general direction from which Resolution was coming, Jimmy did not spot the tiny craft until it had already passed New York.
It seemed incredible that it could carry 6 men and whatever equipment they had brought to rescue him. When it was only a kilometer away, he recognized Commander Norton and started waving. A little later, the skipper spotted him and waved back.
"Glad to see you're in good shape, Jimmy," he radioed. "I promised we wouldn't leave you behind. Now do you believe me?"
Not quite, Jimmy thought. Until this moment he had still wondered if this was all a kindly plot to keep up his morale. But the commander would not have crossed the sea just to say goodbye. He must have worked out something.
"I'll believe you, Skipper," he said, "when I'm down there on the deck. Now will you tell me how I'm going to make it?"
Resolution was slowing down 100 meters from the base of the cliff. As far as Jimmy could tell, she carried no unusual equipment, though he was not sure what he had expected to see.
"Sorry about that, Jimmy, but we didn't want you to have too many things to worry about."
Now, that sounded ominous. What the devil did he mean? Resolution came to a halt, 50 meters out and 500 below. Jimmy had almost a bird's-eye view of the commander as he spoke into his microphone.
"This is it, Jimmy. You'll be perfectly safe, but it will require nerve. We know you've got plenty of that. You're going to jump."
500 meters?
"Yes, but at only half a G."
"So? Have you ever fallen 250 on Earth?"
"Shut up or I'll cancel your next leave. You should have worked this out for yourself. It's just a question of terminal velocity. In this atmosphere, you can't reach more than 90 kilometers an hour, whether you fall 200 or 2,000 meters. 90's a little high for comfort, but we can trim it some more. This is what you'll have to do, so listen carefully."
"I will,"
said Jimmy.
"It had better be good."
He did not interrupt the commander again, and made no comment when Norton had finished. Yes, it made sense, and was so absurdly simple that it would take a genius to think of it, and, perhaps, someone who did not expect to do it himself. Jimmy had never tried high diving, or made a delayed parachute drop, which would have given him some psychological preparation for this feat. One could tell a man that it was perfectly safe to walk a plank across an abyss, yet even if the structural calculations were impeccable, he might still be unable to do it. Now, Jimmy understood why the commander had been so evasive about the details of the rescue. He had been given no time to brood or to think of objections.
"I don't want to hurry you,"
said Norton's persuasive voice from half a kilometer below.
"But the sooner the better."
Jimmy looked at his precious souvenir, the only flower in Rama. He wrapped it carefully in his grimy handkerchief, knotted the fabric, and tossed it over the edge of the cliff. It fluttered down with reassuring slowness, but it also took a very long time, getting smaller and smaller and smaller, until he could no longer see it. But then Resolution surged forward, and he knew that it had been spotted.
"Beautiful!" exclaimed the commander enthusiastically. "I'm sure they'll name it after you." "Okay, we're waiting."
Jimmy stripped off his shirt, the only upper garment anyone ever wore in this now tropical climate, and stretched it thoughtfully. Several times on his trek, he had almost discarded it. Now, it might help to save his life. For the last time, he looked back at the hollow world he alone had explored, and the distant, ominous pinnacles of the Big and Little Horns. Then, grasping the shirt firmly with his right hand, he took a running jump as far out over the cliff as he could. Now, there was no particular hurry. He had a full 20 seconds in which to enjoy the experience. but he did not waste any time, as the wind strengthened around him, and resolution slowly expanded in his field of view. Holding his shirt with both hands, he stretched his arms above his head, so that the rushing air filled the garment and blew it into a hollow tube. As a parachute, it was hardly a success. The few kilometers an hour it subtracted from his speed were useful, but not vital. It was doing a much more important job, keeping his body vertical, so that he would arrow straight into the sea. He still had the impression that he was not moving at all, but that the water below was rushing up toward him. Once he had committed himself, he had no sense of fear. Indeed, he felt a certain indignation against the skipper for keeping him in the dark. Did he really think that he would have been scared to jump if he'd had to brood over it too long? At the last moment, he let go of his shirt, took a deep breath, and grabbed his mouth and nose with his hands. As he had been instructed, he stiffened his body into a rigid bar and locked his feet together. He would enter the water as cleanly as a falling spear. "It will be just the same," the commander had promised, "as stepping off a diving board on Earth. Nothing to it, if you make a good entry."
"And if I don't?" he had asked.
"Then you'll have to go back and try again." Something slapped him across the feet, hard, but not viciously. A million slimy hands were tearing at his body. There was a roaring in his ears, a mounting pressure, and even though his eyes were tightly closed, he could tell that darkness was falling as he arrowed down into the depths of the cylindrical sea. With all his strength, he started to swim upward toward the fading light. He could not open his eyes for more than a single blink. The poisonous water felt like acid when he did so. He seemed to have been struggling for ages, and more than once he had a nightmare fear that he had lost his orientation and was really swimming downward. Then he would risk another quick glimpse, and every time the light was stronger. His eyes were still clenched tightly shut when he broke water. He gulped a precious mouthful of air, rolled over on his back, and looked around. Resolution was heading toward him at top speed. Within seconds, eager hands had grabbed him and dragged him aboard. "Did you swallow any water?" was the commander's anxious question.
"I don't think so."
"Rinse your mouth out with this anyway." "That's fine. How do you feel?"
"I'm not really sure. I'll let you know in a minute."
"Oh, thanks, everybody." The minute was barely up when Jimmy was only too sure how he felt.
"I'm going to be sick," he confessed miserably.
His rescuers were incredulous.
"In a dead calm? On a flat sea?"
protested Sergeant Barnes, who seemed to regard Jimmy's plight as a direct reflection on her skill.
"I'd hardly call it flat," said the commander, waving his arm around at the band of water that circled the sky. "But don't be ashamed. You may have swallowed some of that stuff. Get rid of it as quickly as you can."
Jimmy was still straining, unheroically and unsuccessfully, when there was a flicker of light in the sky behind them. All eyes turned toward the South Pole, and Jimmy instantly forgot his sickness. The horns had started their fireworks display again. There were the kilometer-long streamers of fire, dancing from the central spike to its smaller companions. Once again they began their stately rotation, as if invisible dancers were winding their ribbons around an electric maypole. But now they began to accelerate, moving faster and faster, until they blurred into a flickering cone of light. It was a spectacle more awe-inspiring than any they had yet seen here, and it brought with it a distant crackling roar, which added to the impression of overwhelming power. The display lasted for about 5 minutes, then it stopped, as abruptly as if someone had turned a switch.
I'd like to know what the Rama Committee make of that, Norton muttered to no one in particular. Has anyone here got any theories?
There was no time for an answer, because at that moment, Hub Control called in great excitement.
Resolution, are you okay? Did you feel that?
Feel what?
We think it was an earthquake. It must have happened the minute those fireworks stopped.
Any damage?
I don't think so. It wasn't really violent, but it shook us up a bit.
We felt nothing at all, but we wouldn't, out here in the sea.
Of course. Silly of me. Anyway, everything seems quiet now. Until next time.
Yes, until next time, Norton echoed. The mystery of Rama was steadily growing. The more they discovered about it, the less they understood.
There was a sudden shout from the helm. Skipper, look, up there in the sky.
Norton lifted his eyes and swiftly scanned the circuit of the sea. He saw nothing until his gaze had almost reached the zenith and he was staring at the other side of the world.
My God, he whispered slowly, as he realized that the next time was already almost here.
A tidal wave was racing toward them down the eternal curve of the cylindrical sea.
32. The Wave. Even in that moment of shock, Norton's first concern was for his ship.
Endeavor, he called. Situation report?
All okay, Skipper,
was the reassuring answer from Exec.
We felt a slight tremor, but nothing that could cause any damage. There's been a small change of attitude. The bridge says about 0.2 degrees. They also think the spin rate has altered slightly. We'll have an accurate reading on that in a couple of minutes.
So it's beginning to happen, Norton said to himself. And a lot earlier than we expected. We're still a long way from perihelion and the logical time for an orbit change. But some kind of trim was undoubtedly taking place, and there might be more shocks to come. Meanwhile, the effects of this first one were all too obvious. Up there on the curving sheet of water that seemed perpetually falling from the sky. The wave was about 10 kilometers away and stretched the full width of the sea from northern to southern shore. Near the land, it was a foaming wall of white, but in deeper water, it was a barely visible blue line, moving much faster than the breakers on either flank. The drag of the shoreward shallows was already bending it into a bow, with the central portion getting farther and farther ahead.
Sergeant, said Norton urgently, this is your job. What can we do?
Sergeant Barnes had brought the raft completely to rest and was studying the situation intently. Her expression, Norton was relieved to see, showed no trace of alarm. Rather, a certain zestful excitement, like that of a skilled athlete about to accept a challenge.
I wish we had some soundings, she said.
If we're in deep water, there's nothing to worry about.
Then we're all right. We're about 4 kilometers from shore.
I hope so, but I want to study the situation.
She applied power again and swung Resolution around until it was just underway, heading directly toward the approaching wave. Norton judged that the swiftly moving central portion would reach them in less than 5 minutes, but he could also see that it presented no serious danger. It was only a racing ripple a fraction of a meter high, and would scarcely rock the boat. The walls of foam, lagging far behind it, were the real menace. Suddenly, in the very center of the sea, a line of breakers appeared. The wave had clearly hit a submerged wall, several kilometers in length, not far below the surface. At the same time, the breakers on the two flanks collapsed as they ran into deeper water.
anti-slosh plates, Norton told himself. Exactly the same as in Endeavour's own propellant tanks, but on a thousandfold greater scale. There must be a complex pattern of them all around the sea, to damp out any waves as quickly as possible. The only thing that matters now is, are we right on top of one?
Sergeant Barnes was one jump ahead of him. She brought resolution to a full stop and threw out the anchor. It hit bottom at only 5 meters.
"Haul it up," she called to her crewmates. "We've got to get away from here."
Norton agreed heartily. But in which direction? The sergeant was headed full speed toward the wave, which was now only 5 kilometers away. For the first time, he could hear the sound of its approach, a distant, unmistakable roar, which he had never expected to hear inside Rama. Then it changed in intensity. The central portion was collapsing again, and the flanks again were building up. He tried to estimate the distance between the submerged baffles, assuming that they were spaced at equal intervals. If he was right, there should be one more to come. If they could station the raft in the deep water between them, they would be perfectly safe. Sergeant Barnes cut the motor and threw out the anchor again. It went down 30 meters without hitting bottom.
"We're okay," she said, with a sigh of relief. "But I'll keep the motor running."
Now, there were only the lagging walls of foam along the coast. Out here in the central sea, it was calm again, apart from the inconspicuous blue ripple still speeding toward them. The sergeant was just holding resolution on course toward the disturbance, ready to pour on full power at a moment's notice. Then, only 2 kilometers ahead of them, the sea started to foam once more. It humped up in white-maned fury, and now its roaring seemed to fill the world. Upon the 16-kilometer high wave of the cylindrical sea, a smaller ripple was superimposed, like an avalanche thundering down a mountain slope. And that ripple was quite large enough to kill them. Sergeant Barnes must have seen the expressions on the faces of her crewmates. She shouted above the roar,
"What are you scared about? I've ridden bigger ones than this."
That was not quite true. Nor did she add that her earlier experience had been in a well-built surf boat, not an improvised raft.
"But if we have to jump, wait until I tell you. Check your life jackets."
"She's magnificent, like a Viking warrior going into battle, and obviously enjoying every minute," thought the commander. "And she's probably right, unless we've miscalculated badly."
The wave continued to rise, curving upward and over. The slope above them probably exaggerated its height, but it looked enormous, an irresistible force of nature that would overwhelm everything in its path. Then, within seconds, it collapsed, as if its foundations had been pulled out from underneath it. It was over the submerged barrier, in deep water again. When it reached them a minute later, resolution merely bounced up and down a few times before Sergeant Barnes swung her around and set off at top speed toward the north.
"Thanks, Ruby. That was splendid. But will we get home before it comes around for the second time?"
"Probably not. It will be back in about 20 minutes, but it will have lost all its strength then. We'll scarcely notice it."
Now that the wave had passed, they could relax and enjoy the voyage, though no one would be completely at ease until they were back on land. The disturbance had left the water swirling in random eddies, and had also stirred up a most peculiar acidic smell, like crushed ants, as Jimmy put it well. Though unpleasant, the odor caused none of the attacks of seasickness that might have been expected. It was something so alien that human physiology could not respond to it. A minute later, the wave front hit the next underwater barrier as it climbed away from them and up the sky. This time, seen from the rear, the spectacle was unimpressive, and the voyagers were ashamed of their previous fears. They began to feel themselves masters of the cylindrical sea. The shock was therefore all the greater when, not more than 100 meters away, something like a slowly rotating wheel began to rear up out of the water. Glittering metallic spokes, 5 meters long, emerged dripping, spun for a moment in the fierce Raman glare, and splashed back. It was as if a giant starfish with tubular arms had broken the surface. At first sight, it was impossible to tell whether it was an animal or a machine. Then it flopped over and lay half awash, bobbing up and down in the gentle aftermath of the wave. Now they could see that there were 9 arms, apparently jointed, radiating from a central disc. 2 of the arms were broken, snapped off at the outer joint. The others ended at a complicated collection of manipulators that reminded Jimmy strongly of the crab he had encountered. The 2 creatures came from the same line of evolution, or the same drawing board. At the middle of the disc was a small turret, bearing 3 large eyes. 2 were closed, 1 open, and even that appeared to be blank and unseeing. No one doubted that they were watching the death throes of some strange monster tossed up to the surface by the submarine disturbance that had just passed. Then they saw that it was not alone. Swimming around it and snapping at its still feebly moving limbs were 2 small beasts like overgrown lobsters. They were efficiently chopping up the monster, and it did nothing to resist, though its own claws seemed quite capable of dealing with the attackers. Again, Jimmy was reminded of the crab that had demolished Dragonfly. He watched intently as the one-sided conflict continued, and quickly confirmed his impression.
"Look, Skipper," he whispered. "Do you see? They're not eating it. They don't even have any mouths. They're simply chopping it to pieces. That's exactly what happened to Dragonfly."
"You're right. They're dismantling it like a broken machine."
Norton wrinkled his nose.
"But no dead machine ever smelled like that."
Then another thought struck him.
"My God, suppose they start on us. Ruby, get us back to shore as quickly as you can."
Resolution surged forward with reckless disregard for the life of her power cells. Behind them, the 9 spokes of the great starfish, they could think of no better name for it, were clipped steadily shorter, and presently the weird tableau sank back into the depths of the sea. There was no pursuit, but they did not breathe comfortably again until Resolution had drawn up to the landing stage, and they had stepped thankfully ashore. As he looked back across that mysterious and now sinister band of water, Norton grimly determined that no one would ever sail it again. There were too many unknowns, too many dangers. He looked back upon the towers and ramparts of New York and the dark cliff of the continent beyond. They were safe now from inquisitive man. He would not tempt the gods of Rama again. 33. Spider. From now on, Norton had decreed, there would always be at least 3 people at Camp Alpha, and 1 of them would always be awake. In addition, all exploring parties would follow the same routine. Potentially dangerous creatures were on the move inside Rama, and though none had shown active hostility,
a prudent commander would take no chances. As an extra safeguard, there was always an observer up on the hub, keeping watch through a powerful telescope. From this vantage point, the whole interior of Rama could be surveyed, and even the South Pole appeared to be only a few hundred meters away. The territory around any group of explorers was to be kept under regular observation. In this way, it was hoped to eliminate any possibility of surprise. It was a good plan, and it failed completely. After the last meal of the day, and just before the 2200 sleep period, Norton, Rodrigo, Calvert, and Laura Ernst were watching the regular evening news telecast beamed specially to them from the transmitter at Inferno, Mercury. They had been particularly interested in seeing Jimmy's film of the Southern Hemisphere and the return across the Cylindrical Sea, an episode that had excited all viewers. Scientists, news commentators, and members of the Rama Committee had given their opinions, most of them contradictory. No one could agree whether the crab-like creature Jimmy had encountered was an animal, a machine, a genuine Raman, or something that fitted none of these categories. They had just been watching, with a distinctly queasy feeling, the giant starfish being demolished by its predators, when they discovered that they were no longer alone. There was an intruder in the camp. Laura Ernst noticed it first. She froze, then said, "Don't move, Bill. Now look slowly to the right." Norton turned his head. 10 meters away was a slender-legged tripod surmounted by a spherical body no larger than a soccer ball. Set around the body were three large, expressionless eyes, apparently giving 360 degrees of vision, and trailing beneath it were three whip-like tendrils. The creature was not quite as tall as a man, and looked far too fragile to be dangerous, but that did not excuse their carelessness in letting it sneak up on them unawares. It reminded Norton of nothing so much as a three-legged spider, or Daddy Longlegs, and he wondered how it had solved the problem, never attempted by any creature on Earth, of tripedal locomotion. "What do you make of it, Doc?" he whispered, turning off the voice of the TV newscaster. "Usual Raman threefold symmetry. I don't see how it could hurt us, though those whips might be unpleasant, and they could be poisonous, like Cylenterates. Sit tight and see what it does." After regarding them impassively for several minutes, the creature suddenly moved, and now they could understand why they had failed to observe its arrival. It was fast, and it covered the ground with such an extraordinary spinning motion that the human eye and mind had real difficulty in following it. As far as Norton could judge, and only a high-speed camera could settle the matter, each leg in turn acted as a pivot around which the creature whirled its body. And he was not sure, but it also seemed to him that every few steps it reversed its direction of spin, while the three whips flickered over the ground like lightning as it moved. Its top speed, though this also was hard to estimate, seemed to be at least 30 kilometers an hour. It swept swiftly around the camp, examining every item of equipment, delicately touching the improvised beds and chairs and tables, communication gear, food containers, electrosands, cameras, water tanks, tools. There seemed to be nothing that it ignored, except the four watchers. Clearly, it was intelligent enough to draw a distinction between humans and their inanimate property. Its actions gave the unmistakable impression of an extremely methodical curiosity or inquisitiveness. "I wish I could examine it," Laura exclaimed in frustration as the creature continued its swift pirouette.
Shall we try to catch it?
How?
Calvert asked, reasonably enough.
You know, the way primitive hunters bring down fast-moving animals with a couple of weights whirling around at the end of a rope? It doesn't even hurt them.
That, I doubt, said Norton. But even if it worked, we can't risk it. We don't know how intelligent this creature is, and a trick like that could easily break its legs. Then we would be in real trouble, from Rama, Earth, and everyone else.
But I've got to have a specimen.
You may have to be content with Jimmy's flower, unless one of these creatures cooperates with you. Force is out. How would you like it if something landed on Earth and decided that you would make a nice specimen for dissection?
I don't want to dissect it, said Laura, not at all convincingly. I only want to examine it.
Well, alien visitors might have the same attitude toward you, but you could have a very uncomfortable time before you believed them.
We must make no move that could possibly be regarded as threatening.
He was quoting from ship's orders, of course, and Laura knew it. The claims of science had a lower priority than those of space diplomacy. In fact, there was no need to bring in such elevated considerations. It was merely a matter of good manners. They were all visitors here, and had never even asked permission to come inside. The creature seemed to have finished its inspection. It made one more high-speed circuit of the camp, then shot off at a tangent toward the stairway.
I wonder how it's going to manage the steps,
Laura mused. Her question was quickly answered. The spider ignored them completely and headed up the gently sloping curve of the ramp without slackening its speed. Hub control, said Norton. You may have a visitor shortly. Take a look at Stairway Alpha, Section 6. And incidentally, thanks a lot for keeping such a good watch on us. It took a minute for the sarcasm to sink in. Then the hub observer started to make apologetic noises.
I can just see something, Skipper. Now you tell me it's there. But what is it?
Your guess is as good as mine, Norton answered, as he pressed the general alert button.
Camp Alpha calling all stations. We've just been visited by a creature like a three-legged spider, with very thin legs, about 2 meters high, small spherical body. Travels very fast, with a spinning motion. Appears harmless, but inquisitive. It may sneak up on you before you notice it. Please acknowledge.
The first reply came from London, 15 kilometers to the east.
Nothing unusual here, Skipper.
From the same distance to the west, Rome answered, sounding suspiciously sleepy.
Same here, Skipper. Just a moment.
What is it?
I put my pen down a minute ago, and it's gone.
What? Oh! Talk sense.
You won't believe this, Skipper. I was making some notes. You know I like writing, and it doesn't disturb anybody. And I was using my favorite ballpoint. It's nearly 200 years old. Well, now it's lying on the ground, about 5 meters away. I've got it. Thank goodness it isn't damaged.
And how do you suppose it got there?
I may have dozed off for a minute. It's been a hard day.
Norton sighed, but refrained from comment. There were so few of them, and they had so little time in which to explore a world. Enthusiasm could not always overcome exhaustion, and he wondered if they were taking unnecessary risks. Perhaps he should not split his men up into such small groups and try to cover so much territory, but he was always conscious of the swiftly passing days and the unsolved mysteries around them. He was becoming more and more certain that something was about to happen, and that they would have to abandon Rama even before it reached perihelion, the moment of truth when any orbit change must surely take place.
Now listen, Hub, Rome, London, everyone, he said. I want a report every half hour through the night. We must assume that from now on we may have visitors at any time. Some of them may be dangerous, but at all costs we have to avoid incidents. You all know the directives on this subject."
That was true enough. It was part of their training. Yet perhaps none of them had ever really believed that the long-theorized physical contact with intelligent aliens would occur in their lifetimes, still less that they would experience it themselves. Training was one thing, reality another, and no one could be sure that the ancient human instincts of self-preservation would not take over in an emergency. Yet it was essential to give every entity they encountered in Rama the benefit of the doubt, up to the last possible minute, and even beyond. Commander Norton did not want to be remembered by history as the man who started the first interplanetary war. Within a few hours, there were hundreds of the spiders, and they were all over the plain. Through the telescope, it could be seen that the southern hemisphere was also infested with them, but not, it seemed, the island of New York. They took no further notice of the explorers, and after a while the explorers took little notice of them, though from time to time Norton detected a predatory gleam in his surgeon commander's eye. Nothing would please her better, he was sure, than for one of the spiders to have an unfortunate accident, and he would not put it past her to arrange such a thing in the interests of science. It seemed virtually certain that the spiders could not be intelligent. Their bodies were far too small to contain much in the way of brains, and indeed, it was hard to see where they stored all the energy to move. Yet their behavior was curiously purposeful and coordinated. They appeared to be everywhere, but they never visited the same place twice. Norton frequently had the impression that they were searching for something. Whatever it was, they did not seem to have discovered it. They went all the way up to the central hub, scorning the three great stairways. How they managed to ascend the vertical sections, even under almost zero gravity, was not clear. Laura theorized that they were equipped with suction pads. And then, to her obvious delight, she got her eagerly desired specimen. Hub control reported that a spider had fallen down the vertical face and was lying, dead or incapacitated, on the first platform. Laura's time up from the plane was a record that would never be beaten. When she arrived at the platform, she found that, despite the low velocity of impact, the creature had broken all its legs. Its eyes were open, but it showed no reactions to any external tests. Even a fresh human corpse would have been livelier, Laura thought. As soon as she got her prize back to the Endeavor, she started to work with her dissecting kit. The spider was so fragile that it almost came to pieces without her assistance. She disarticulated the legs, then started on the delicate carapace, which split along three great circles and opened up like a peeled orange. After some moments of blank incredulity, for there was nothing that she could recognize or identify, she took a series of careful photographs. Then she picked up her scalpel. Where to start cutting? She felt like closing her eyes and stabbing at random, but that would not have been very scientific. The blade went in with practically no resistance. A second later, Surgeon Commander Ernst's most unladylike yell echoed the length and breadth of Endeavor. It took an annoyed Sergeant McAndrews a good 20 minutes to calm down the startled Simps. 34. His Excellency regrets. "As you are all aware, gentlemen," said the Martian ambassador,
A great deal has happened since our last meeting. We have much to discuss and to decide. I'm therefore particularly sorry that our distinguished colleague from Mercury is not here. That last statement was not altogether accurate. Dr. Bose was not particularly sorry that His Excellency the Hermian Ambassador was absent. It would have been much more truthful to say that he was worried. All his diplomatic instincts told him that something was happening, and though his sources of information were excellent, he could gather no hints as to what it might be. The ambassador's letter of apology had been courteous and entirely uncommunicative. His Excellency had regretted that urgent and unavoidable business had kept him from attending the meeting, either in person or by video. Dr. Bose found it hard to think of anything more urgent or more important than Rama. Two of our members have statements to make. I would first like to call on Professor Davidson. There was a rustle of excitement among the other scientists on the committee. Most of them had felt that the astronomer, with his well-known cosmic viewpoint, was not the right man to be chairman of the Space Advisory Council. He sometimes gave the impression that the activities of intelligent life were an unfortunate irrelevance in the majestic universe of stars and galaxies, and that it was bad manners to pay too much attention to them. This had not endeared him to exobiologists such as Dr. Pereira, who took exactly the opposite view. For them, the only purpose of the universe was the production of intelligence, and they were apt to talk sneeringly about purely astronomical phenomena. "Mere dead matter," was one of their favorite phrases. "Mr. Ambassador," the scientist began, "I have been analyzing the curious behavior of Rama during the last few days and would like to present my conclusions. Some of them are rather startling." Dr. Pereira looked surprised, then a little smug. He strongly approved of anything that startled Davidson. "First of all, there was the remarkable series of events when that young lieutenant," he pronounced it lieutenant, "flew over to the southern hemisphere. The electrical discharges themselves, though spectacular, are not important. It is easy to show that they contained relatively little energy. But they coincided with a change in Rama's rate of spin and its attitude, that is, its orientation in space. This must have involved an enormous amount of energy, the discharges which nearly cost Mr. Pack his life were merely a minor byproduct, perhaps a nuisance that had to be minimized by those giant lightning conductors at the South Pole. I draw two conclusions from this. When a spacecraft, and we must call Rama a spacecraft despite its fantastic size, makes a change of attitude, that usually means it is about to make a change of orbit. We must therefore take seriously the views of those who believe that Rama may be preparing to become another planet of our sun, instead of going back to the stars. If this is the case, Endeavor must obviously be prepared to cast off. Is that what spaceships do? At a moment's notice. She may be in very serious danger while she is still physically attached to Rama. I imagine that Commander Norton is already well aware of this possibility, but I think we should send him an additional warning."
"Thank you very much, Professor Davidson." "Yes, Professor Solomons."
"I'd like to comment on that," said the science historian. "Rama seems to have made a change of spin without using any jets or reaction devices. This leaves only two possibilities, it seems to me. The first one is that it has internal gyroscopes, or their equivalent. They must be enormous. Where are they? The second possibility, which would turn all our physics upside down, is that it has a reactionless propulsion system, the so-called space drive, which Professor Davidson doesn't believe in. If this is the case,
Rama may be able to do almost anything. We will be quite unable to anticipate its behavior, even on the gross physical level.
The diplomats were obviously somewhat baffled by this exchange, and the astronomer refused to be drawn. He had gone out on enough limbs for one day.
I'll stick to the laws of physics, if you don't mind, until I'm forced to give them up. If we've not found any gyroscopes in Rama, we may not have looked hard enough, or in the right place.
Bose could see that Pereira was getting impatient. Normally, the exobiologist was as happy as anyone else to engage in speculation, but now, for the first time, he had some solid facts. His long impoverished science had become wealthy overnight.
Very well. If there are no other comments, I know that Dr. Pereira has some important information.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. As you've all seen, we have at last obtained a specimen of a Rama life form and have observed several others at close quarters. Surgeon Commander Ernst, Endeavour's medical officer, has sent a full report on the spider-like creature she dissected. I must say at once that some of her results are baffling, and in any other circumstances, I would have refused to believe them. The spider is definitely organic, though its chemistry differs from ours in many respects. It contains considerable quantities of light metals, yet I hesitate to call it an animal, for several fundamental reasons. In the first place, it seems to have no mouth, no stomach, no gut, no method of ingesting food. Also, no air intakes, no lungs, no blood, no reproductive system. You may wonder what it has got. Well, there's a simple musculature controlling its three legs and the three whip-like tendrils or feelers. There's a brain, fairly complex, mostly concerned with the creature's remarkably developed triocular vision, but 80% of the body consists of a honeycomb of large cells, and this is what gave Dr. Ernst such an unpleasant surprise when she started her dissection. If she'd been luckier, she might have recognized it in time, because it's the one Raman structure that does exist on Earth, though only in a handful of marine animals. Most of the spider is simply a battery, much like that found in electric eels and rays. But in this case, it's apparently not used for defense. It's the creature's source of energy, and that is why it has no provisions for eating and breathing. It doesn't need such primitive arrangements. And, incidentally, this means that it would be perfectly at home in a vacuum. So, we have a creature which, to all intents and purposes, is nothing more than a mobile eye. It has no organs of manipulation. Those tendrils are much too feeble. If I had been given its specifications, I would have said it's merely a reconnaissance device. Its behavior certainly fits that description. All the spiders ever do is run around and look at things. That's all they can do. But the other animals are different. The crab, the starfish, the sharks, for want of better words, these can obviously manipulate their environment and appear to be specialized for various functions. I assume that they are also electrically powered, since, like the spider, they appear to have no mouths. I'm sure you'll appreciate the biological problems raised by all this. Could such creatures evolve naturally? I really don't think so. They appear to be designed, like machines, for specific jobs. If I had to describe them, I would say that they are robots, biological robots, something that has no analogy on Earth. If Rama is a spaceship, perhaps they are part of its crew. As to how they are born or created, that's something I can't tell you. But I can guess that the answer's over there in New York.
If Commander Norton and his men can wait long enough, they may encounter increasingly more complex creatures with unpredictable behavior. Somewhere along the line, they may meet the Ramans themselves, the real makers of this world. And when that happens,